A year ago, I set out to create a podcast celebrating some of the people I've worked with and who are thinking differently about managing land for people and for nature. I'm Pete Leeson, and welcome to Series 3 of Tree Amble Podcast. This is a podcast about people and farming and trees and nature and how we can all do much better. I went to meet Phil and Katrina at LDF, Lake District Farmers, on a small industrial estate in South Cumbria. LDF was created as a vehicle to support Cumbrian farmers by providing routes to market for quality meats. Whilst as a vegetarian, I find this challenging, I am on record as supporting the sort of farming where we create quality meats in natural systems. Our quality meat producers need support across the supply chain, and they need us to support them through good conversation and good science. So, a vegetarian has just come to the south of the county, Cumbria, to sit in a meat production facility and talk meat.
Yes.
With Phil Scott. So, hi, Phil.
Hi.
You're a Warrington lad, but you've adopted Cumbria as your home.
Yes. I've been here for a number of years. I actually now live just in North Lancashire because I met my now wife and I moved in with her and we've been there ever since. But Cumbria is essentially my adopted county. I love the area. I think it's the people that I love the most.
Yeah.
They're so varied, especially when it comes to the farmers.
Well, we met on a farm, didn't we?
We did.
And that was where we first met, really.
Yeah.
And I was, I suppose, a little bit curious about what you were trying to achieve, really, because you were talking about quality meats and all this kind of stuff. And I there's a little bit of me that thinks, how much of this is greenwashing? But we'll maybe go there, really.
Yeah.
But quality meats is what you're aiming for, isn't it?
Yeah, so the firm was set up in 2009 by Dan Austin and Ray Armstrong, and the whole idea of the business model back then was to basically provide a sustainable future for Cumbrian fowl farms. That's our motto now.
Yeah.
It wasn't back then, but that's essentially what they were going for, and they wanted to create a viable output for farmers that were creating great produce and sell it into restaurants, to chefs that understood provenance.
Mm-hmm.
It really started to come into its own provenance-led produce in restaurants towards the end of 2010, 2011. They really started to understand it. And now it's basically, you can't sell anything into these restaurants that we work with without the chef understanding where the product comes from,
whether
that's asparagus or flour or meat,
So you think those chefs have actually, that sustainability message is beginning to get through, is it?
Huge, yeah, definitely. I think, a lot of the work that I do is engagement work. So I do a lot of what we call them farm tours. This is where I'll take a number of chefs and front of house. Mm-hmm. I think front of house is very key because we need those guys, because they're on the front line, explaining to their guests where the meat comes from. Because most of those people, particularly in London, which is our main market, probably never been north of Watford, explaining to them is a good thing.
So for me, as a conservation perspective, I think meat has some interesting, there's some interesting stuff about the meat conversation, isn't there? I think we eat too much meat, and I'm very concerned about a lot of the uplands in Cumbria and elsewhere being overgrazed. So how do we enter that conversation, really? Because you're talking about quality meats and providing an outlet for those farms and farm sales. How do we square that circle between meat production, overgrazing, and getting it right?
It's really interesting because we've kind of spoken from day one, LDF, to eat less meat.
Yeah.
which is really strange. And when we were talking to some of our competitors in London, they thought we were mad as a box of frogs. Yeah. But generally, we actually believe that you should eat less meat. But what you should be doing is when you are eating meat, is you should... I sometimes use the terminology of addressing it like a glass of wine, even if you don't drink. You know, people always think like, you know, you want to drink that glass of wine because you're tasting that certain terroir. Mm. And we believe it's the same with the meat that we're buying from the farm. So what we're trying to do is to take the meat from the farmers, improve that flavour by dry aging the meat and sort of condensing the flavour. My MD will call it the reverse Vimto effect, right, removing the water. Yeah, so you've got that concentrated flavour. Yeah. And that's where we kind of started. And then it was about 4 years ago where we started to make connections with... We were invited to various cohorts, particularly with Lancaster University, mm-hmm. Where they started talking about carbon, which was kind of our first rung on the ladder of sustainability, which I think it is for most companies now. Yeah. It's a good one because it gets not just the investors involved, but it also gets the accountants involved. I'm not an accountant. My role is head of purpose and sustainability. Yeah. But in order to do the initiatives that I want to do, I need the accountants to understand it as well.
So carbon is, it's a short, isn't it? Carbon dioxide use.
Yeah.
It's a sustainability kind of thing, is it? People think carbon sustainability, it's kind of almost in the same box, isn't it?
But yeah, I try to sort of use it as a way to kind of get people to understand the kind of almost like the first step, you know, when you go out on a hike, it's the first, you look at the map, that's the map, right, let's go. And as you go on the route, you see the flowers, you see the trees, you see the rivers, and the picture builds up as you walk.
Yeah.
And it's the same with carbon when I'm talking to the customers. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. And then I start going hard on the biodiversity side of things and the work we're doing with Lancaster, because off those cohorts, we're now doing a massive project with them.
So Laura, unfortunately, can't be with us because she's got COVID.
Bless her.
Which is a shame because I was wanting to talk to Laura. But just explain what Laura is doing for you.
So she's the doctor. Right. Okay. I'm the face that talks. So Laura is what's called a knowledge transfer associate.
Yep.
The project is called Towards Net Zero Meat Production, and it's a collaboration between Lake District Farmers and the LEC, the Lancaster Environment Centre, mm-hmm. and the soil scientists in there, and the Pentland Centre for Sustainable Business Models, which is where the environmental accountants sit. And what we're doing is we're looking at a case study on 5 farms spread across the lakes, mm-hmm. using the different types of soils and the rocks to ascertain what their current carbon baseline is, mm-hmm. and then flesh out or design a financial framework, which then we can spread out through our network and beyond to say to our farmers, you know, we do need to start, you know, looking at this quite seriously, and if you are struggling, here's a hand to help you along this route, essentially.
I mean, that just flashes up lots of things in my mind, really, because obviously I know John Quinton, he's part of the AXS Atlanticresta, which is fantastic. We've had an interview with John, so I can see where the soil comes into this. Accounting, absolutely key, and obviously with a lot of the farmers we're talking to and about, their economic circumstances are really quite pushed. So the payments we're getting through taxpayer, government, whatever, BPS, that's going.
Yep.
So how do we bring in money in a different way? I'm trying to impact on those guys by getting to produce less meat.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about quality meat and the carbon story. Mm-hmm. So it does come together in the same space, doesn't it, somewhere?
Totally, yeah. I think there's a lot of synergy there. And I think one of the things that we look at when we're taking on new farmers is the first question is, you know, how many animals do you have and how much acres do you have? Because you get a good rough idea of just how intensive the farm is or isn't. And I think that's one of the key elements of that, that we look at now. We probably wouldn't have done in the past, and I'll be open and honest with you. We've all made mistakes. Yep. But I think it's only through those mistakes that you learn. You know, my old man, he would say, you know, a calm sea never made a skilled sailor.
Yeah.
I'm definitely getting skilled.
One of the first meetings we had, I mean, I think we went out and we walked up a fell and we looked at the landscape. And I asked you questions about that landscape and your understanding of it.
Yeah, and we went up with Dan, the MD, didn't we? Yeah. And I thought, because I'd already met you once, and, you know, aside from my work at LDF, one of my biggest passions in life always has been trees.
Yeah.
And I kind of see you as a bit of the oracle. I was quite lucky when I grew up. There was an enormous, still is, sycamore tree in our front garden when I was growing up. And my bedroom faced it.
Yeah.
I was in a bungalow. Yeah. And I just watched this tree change throughout the seasons. And I was mesmerised by it. And from that day, trees have always played a big part in my life. I'm quite lucky. I've got an enormous beech tree in my back garden now, which I look at with joy, and that's great. And when I realised that you were going to be quite important to our farmers in planting trees and increasing the amount of trees on farms and hedgerows and so on, I knew that Dan had to meet you. Mm. And I think rather than sitting in the boardroom, which we're doing today, what better way than to get out, hike up a fell, and see for himself?
I put you through your paces, didn't I?
You did. Well, I'd just come out of COVID, so I was struggling.
but I mean, it wasn't just the trees, though, because for me, it's like looking at grass and saying, "Well, looking at grass in a field, how do you tell the difference between grass that's been heavily fertilised, and grass that's been mob grazed?
Yes,
because they're both green.
Yeah, yeah."
And grass that's perhaps rough graze or whatever. And those sort of questions about understanding the landscape, because then that leads you back into how is that, what's that farmer actually doing? What is he telling you he's doing? What is he actually doing?
Mm-hmm.
Are they different?
Mm-hmm.
And that then leads you to thinking about the meat production and the animal husbandry and everything else.
Yes.
So I think the landscape and reading the landscape is really important in this.
It is, absolutely. And I've learned an awful lot from people such as yourself and John, and some of the farmers who are really progressive and looking at their farm and how it works. I was on a farm walk a couple of months ago, and we were stood on a farm, and they had an amazing herbal lays running down this field.
So herbal lays, for those people that don't know?
Yeah, for herbal lays is basically a scheme where you can reintroduce almost like meadows of the past almost. Yeah. And it's a scheme that's paid for by the government, I believe. As a non-farmer, so I'm not. Probably a lot of farmers out there saying that's not right, but that's essentially what I think it is. And this herbal lays in particular was looking particularly luscious and green, like it had been fertilised.
Yeah.
And there was an old farmer there who was sort of looking at it, sort of with his arms folded, and he'd said, "You know, when did you last fertilise the soil?" And he said, "Well, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, something like that." Yeah. He was like, "Well, so you haven't done it this year."
Yeah.
He was like, "No." So, no fertilizer. You had to keep going back around it. But it's and you could just see that little light bulb moment, ding, and then all of a sudden he got it. You know, and I think that's really important. Those kind of little moments of realization.
So you're learning. You've been on a journey.
Mm.
You're learning stuff and picking up stuff, and I know we've nagged at you a couple of times, and we've had those conversations. Other people are also having their go, but it is interesting to see how you're now, as a business, thinking about sustainability thoroughly. Mm. And we're going to talk to people later about solar panels and all that kind of stuff that's happening in the building. Are you translating your learning back to those farms, and how do you approach that conversation?
Yeah, so when, I think the thing to explain is when you're breaking down your carbon footprint for a business, which is the main way that we do it at the moment, you have your scopes 1 and 2, which is your solar panels and your fleets and your electricity and your gas and your water, and then your scope 3 is everything else. So a lot of firms will cover their scopes 1 and 2 quite quickly, because most of that you'll be able to find through your invoicing.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite easy to ascertain. Scope 3, much more difficult. Even for a business as small as ours, our network is pretty complex.
Mm.
And trying to get our heads around that is difficult. I remember one of the academics for the KTP, Professor Jan Bedminton, who's the environmental accountant, she said fairly recently that, you know, if someone says they're going to change the way they do everything within 2 years, don't believe them. If they're going to change everything they're gonna, within 100 years, don't believe them. But if they say, you know, 15 years, well, then you get, you know, that's a good time to get things changed. And that's essentially the mindset that we've got. So we've got a network of farmers that supply us directly, which is great. And some of them are on the environmental route on their farms, some more progressive than others. And then the rest of the farmers in the network that might not necessarily be on that route, it's how do we help them to understand it and understand the value that sits in there. Because I'm always a glass half full type of guy, I always have been. I believe in hope, even when it's most darkest. And I think it's our duty that we've given these farmers, because we always pay above market price for them, for the meat, you see. And it's enabled these farmers to reinvest in their farms, whether that's back into environmental things or maybe a new tractor or whatever it is. And we feel our purpose is to basically, now we're in this transition, to help them, to support them. And that's why we're doing this work with Lancaster University.
So how long's that project?
2 years.
2 years.
Yeah, so it's basically running, obviously Laura's suffering with COVID at the moment, and when she comes back in, the funding will kick back in again, and then we'll kick on. But where we're at the moment is I spent the first 2 months of our work together running around all the different farms in the Lake District, introducing Laura to lots of different farms, not just farms that supply LDF. I wanted her to see other farms that might not necessarily, people like Sam and Claire, you know, so that she can see how other systems work. It's just trying to build up her kind of map of where everything is, and then from that we've kind of ascertained where we need to start looking at the farms. We've also looked at what kind of rock lies under the soil, because that dictates. Some of the farms are on limestone, some are on granite, some are on slate, and that sometimes dictates what happens with the soil. John will tell you more about that, because he's the professor. You see a running thing here. I'm more like the guy who sits in a bed and brings all these people together.
I think that's what I am. I mean, you know, people say you're the expert on this and that. And it's like, no, I'm not really. I know lots of people who do lots of good stuff. I am one of those facilitators. I think you're a facilitator as well. And that's probably maybe why we're talking to each other.
I think so.
It's good to find the person in the middle who can facilitate is a really key individual. So that two-year project, what does it deliver? Does it deliver something for you, or you said there's lots of people involved in this? What's that project going to deliver?
So essentially, what it's going to deliver for us is hopefully a net zero product that we can then sell to our customers. And that's kind of our first major rung on the ladder, as I said before, to try and get our customers. They're already understanding it, because they're already putting pressure onto us from downstream. So I guess I should, with that in mind, should sort of maybe explain a bit about our customer base.
Yeah, absolutely.
So basically, most of our work is delivered into inside the M25. So we're delivering into the high-end restaurants. You will have seen some of our chefs on the television. And these are fine dining restaurants, so they're looking for the best quality meat possible. And now, particularly, with a sustainability angle to it as well. The problem with that is that because we're buying four carcasses from the farmers, and these fine dining restaurants might want, say, like the lamb racks or the beef ribs or the fillet, you know, what do you do with the rest of the cow? It's called the body balance. And it's essentially selling the whole thing nose to tail. And the way that we do that is to bolster the fine dining side. We have corporate hospitality contracts with big companies that facilitate, you know, it can be anywhere from, you know, breakfast, lunch and dinner, and then fine dining also. And this is for their staff. So these are big, like, multinationals, big banks, big tech firms that we work with. And these are people that are acutely aware of their impact on the environment. You know, I've spoken to many directors, and they're quite worried. and rightly so.
Good.
But they're also because it makes my job easier.
We kind of need to turn things around, don't we? I mean, the predictions I've seen this week about climate change are horrific.
Yeah, not so good.
Absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
And anyone with children should be worried. So
totally.
Those directors have got children, they should be worried. Sorry, carry on.
But this absolutely. But this is the thing, though, and they totally get where we're coming from, and they back us 100%, and that's why they'll always pay a premium for the product, because they know the work we're doing on the farms, particularly the work that you do, where you're looking at helping these farmers to replant the hedges that we ripped out. So we're putting back what we've destroyed, peat restoration, tree planting, biodiversity net gain is a big thing. It's essentially if we lose our biodiversity, we lose our availability to produce food.
Yeah.
Period. That's it, end of. And then we don't have a job. You've got 14 butchers in there. You've got our distribution team. Our staff turnover here is incredibly low. Because people find it a hoot to work here, but also, it's...
I think we should come back to the business, because I'm interested in the business as well and what you're doing. But let's go back to those directors down in London who are eating your fine dining meats.
You'll talk to them and... And quite a lot of them are aware that this whole 1.5 degree increase is a fantasy. They're really concerned that we're looking at least 3 to 4 degree increase. How does that affect their business models? Because the way that one of the honorary fellows at Lancaster put it is that factories are connected to their environment.
Yeah.
Every single factory, regardless of what they produce. And LDF is no different. I think we're actually probably closer to our environment than most factories because we work directly with the farmers. Most meat suppliers just buy direct from a massive slaughterhouse and you don't know where that's come from, and it's a bit more convoluted. We're a bit more direct. And I think that's what basically makes our business model tick, because we understand just how fragile that system is. If we don't understand it and start to help it to recover, our business will fall flat on its face, to be honest.
So where is your meat slaughtered?
So most of our meat is slaughtered at HC Aries, A-side. Mm-hmm. And this is because it's in Cumbria.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's a bit of an issue in the UK at the moment with small local abattoirs closing down. And it's something that I've been a part of to try and sort of broaden the awareness, particularly with people like DEFRA. They need to understand just how bad it really is at the moment. I'm sure they do.
So why is it bad? What's the situation?
So small local abattoirs are closing at a rate of knots, and that's leaving farmers that are doing smaller batches, like the ones that we work with, without any avenue to sell their meats locally.
Why are they closing?
There's a multitude of different reasons. The main one is legislation's getting harder and harder and harder.
Right.
A lot of these slaughterhouses are generally generationally owned, and the younger generation just don't want to take on the headache. Money, it's a difficult business, there's a lot of issues, but I think it's becoming harder for people to run slaughterhouses than it was maybe even 5 years ago.
Right.
Setting up one would be, without the money, I don't know how it would work.
So part of your whole business is reliant on another business. So you're the symbiotic relationship there, isn't it? You've got to provide them with work, and they've got to provide you with a product you're happy with.
That's absolutely right. And without them, and they are a massive cog in our business model, I think we would struggle. I think if you send and this could. I could be corrected if I'm wrong here, but from what I've understood from the farmers is that if they were to send their carcasses into one of the big slaughterhouses that supply the majority of the meat in the UK, they'll put their brilliant animals through that have been maybe like a pasture-fed system, which they're really proud of, and then we'll get the same weight of meat back.
So you won't get the same animals back?
No.
So
the sustainability story kind of just stops there, and all the hard work that we've done to understand the farmers, and the farmers have changed the way, it just gets lost in the ether.
So we had the same conversation with Mark and Jenny Lee about their milk. Yeah, lovely organic milk that they're making fantastic cheese from.
Tasty.
Was going in the tanker, getting mixed up with everybody else's.
Yeah.
And whilst whatever they did on the farm was lost by the time it went past the gate.
Yes.
So this is a fundamental problem. And for me, I've been trying to persuade people to plant trees, do hedges, all that kind of stuff, think about mob grazing, change how they reduce their fertilizer use, reduce pesticide herbs, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
To me, it's part of the biodiversity and climate change story. But a lot of those people are now using what we'd call hairy cows.
Yeah.
And you know, that, so there's a butchery thing with hairy cows, which is that they don't present in the same way that perhaps the more conventional cows would.
Yeah, we've always preferred the hairier cows, yeah. Because they're smaller. We generally look for a dead weight of about anywhere between sort of 320, 360, which kilos dead. Yeah, and that's really what we're looking for. So what we're looking for is those shorter legged animals. And the reason why we want them is because they're generally slower growing.
Mm-hmm.
Most meat that goes through into places like the supermarkets, you'd be lucky if it's been living past 18 months. I mean, I was looking at some white Galloways yesterday. They were 4 years old.
Mm.
A magnificent beast, though. Mm. They were really good. And we want that depth of flavour, which you get with older animals. And it also means that the farmer can particularly... conservation grazing is concerned, they can let them on there for longer.
Yeah.
And it works for them, it works for us.
And in terms of the animals then, you've also got the potential to have calves running with mothers for longer. You've
yep.
got all of that sort of animals working as they should do
yes,
in
yeah.
groups, which mm-hmm. we're not getting in the conventional system.
No, because things are weaned and then that's off.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's difficult. And I do feel for the big intensive beef farms, because I think they've been lured into a false sense of security for the last, how many, 20 years or whatever the BPS has been in place for. And it hasn't really enabled them to look at their business thoroughly. Mm-hmm. I think they've thought, well, I know their business on paper, it looks like it's lost money, but actually at the end of the day, we get a big payment, so it doesn't matter.
Mm.
You know, and it doesn't allow you to think differently and challenge yourself.
Yeah.
So
what proportion of the meat you're buying from farms is 100% pasture-fed?
At the moment, it's quite small because we are in a transition. And it's like I said before, with Jan's analogy, you know, change things in 2 years, don't believe them. Change in 100 years, don't believe them. 15 years.
Yeah.
So my idea is that as we navigate through this, I mean, we've got... Recently, I've taken on about 4 or 5 farms, and they are predominantly pasture-fed based systems, and they are going through the certification.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for some farmers to transition. And I think I had a really good conversation with Mark and Jenny, funnily enough, about their field and when they went in, and they said, "Right, I'm not going to fertilize,"
yeah, yeah.
And the field went backwards.
Yeah.
And it's just about learning, and I think it's just about creating a strategy that, you know, gradually. The farm can migrate to the point where it starts to wean itself off the corrective variable costs, which is grain, diesel, you know, once they start to get to that point.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really interesting because, you know, the way that LDS works, because we're so small, the profit margin is easier to control because you're producing less, which means your quality is better, which means you're having less inputs, basically. And that's how we've kind of worked it.
But are you able to pay a premium? I mean, you're selling into the market that will pay them probably the highest price, aren't you?
Yeah.
Is that the model? Because, I mean, one of the things which we've got to get is we've got to get this idea across. We've got to get a change in food production.
Yes.
Which brings in the best of food for everybody.
Yeah. I think the best way to look at it is strategy against culture. So when I'm looking at a sustainable initiative... whether it be inside LDF or outside LDF, first thing to understand is the culture, paramount. Because if your strategy does not align with that culture will eat it for breakfast.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, that's how difficult it is. So you must make sure that you get the culture down. That's why I spend so much time on farms, because even Cumbria is separated out into various sort of parcels, you know, the east side and the west side, completely different, the mindset's different. So it's trying to understand all that so that when we do start to say, right, we need you to start applying these pasture-based systems, I'm going down the route that they understand,
yeah.
that they can get their head around.
Yeah.
Because the one thing I don't want to do is to bash people around the head and say, right, if you don't do X and Y and Z by X, Y and Z date, you're out.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not buying your meat.
It's not the way we like to do business at all, in any shape or form, and particularly with the farmers.
Yeah.
It's about understanding the culture, aligning the strategy with it, and then it will work. But if you don't do that, if you just create a strategy and say, right, by X date, everything's going to be pasture fed, that's it. And whoever isn't on that route, cheerio. It doesn't work like that.
I'd quite like to just understand how many people you employ, because this business has grown. I mean, you're in a really swanky unit now, aren't you?
Yeah, it's the mothership, as Laura would call it. Yeah.
It's a nice new building.
Yes.
Did you have it built for you?
Yes, we did. So we were actually in a premises about 10 minutes down the road back towards Barrow and Furness for a number of years. That's where the business was started. And unfortunately, we suffered a catastrophic fire. It was an old building, and unfortunately, I think, like most old buildings, it was just one of those. It went up. It was a freak, they call it an act of God. And that was on a Saturday. Mm-hmm. And by Monday morning, we were back open for business, albeit with no dry-aged meat. And that was because we have a great network, not just with the farmers, but we made a few phone calls, and we found that the meat processing plant up at Junction 38 was lying dormant.
Mm-hmm.
We knew it existed, but we didn't know what it was like, or we'd never really been there.
Yeah.
To our knowledge, it was currently being used, but it was basically mothballed. So we went up there and had a look, and it was brilliant, really, really interesting spot. Moved in there, and it was kind of the factory we thought. If we were to build one, this is the one we would build.
Yeah.
And after 5 years of being in there, we realised it's not the building that we would build. We learned a lot being in there.
Yeah.
And off the back of that, that's how this site was designed. So,
But you're now employing 38 people?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, Katrina will be able to give you the exact numbers, but it's there or thereabouts.
And are those fully trained people, or are you training people up?
A bit of both. So we've got some butchers in there that have been doing it since they were like 12. People like David Dole, who's the production director. He's been doing butchery for as long as he can remember, and he runs the department, and we have butchers of varying levels under him, and we have a apprenticeship scheme that we're running at the moment, which is bringing young people into the trade to introduce them, because it is a dying trade, particularly what we do, because it is whole carcass butchery. Most butchers, we've had butchers that apply for the job that have only ever really done maybe one thing. Might have worked on the line in an abattoir, so they might have just been boning out a ribeye or something. So trying to show them how we operate can take some time to learn. So that's how we do it.
And are you bringing in funding for that, or is that cost the business?
Yeah, I believe it's a government-backed scheme that we're in. So it's not something that I'm completely okay with.
That's fine. But I'm just trying. So this, you're employing people locally. You've got local people working here.
They all are. Yeah.
I mean, Cumbria is in it's a tourist-based economy, but actually we need other jobs and things in here.
Yes.
So I'm kind of interested in this virtuous circle of good meat production, good environmental standards, sustainability, and local jobs.
Yes.
Because we need to employ people.
Yeah, yeah.
At all structures in society.
Absolutely.
So that's really important.
Yeah.
The other thing is that this building has got solar panels on it.
Yep.
It's got water recycling, or
So basically, we've completely emitted gas. So there's not a boiler on site.
Right.
So everything's generated by either the solar panels, or we do draw from the grid as well at the moment. We've got 188 solar panels on the roof, and we're looking to expand that. It's currently where we're sat here. It goes straight across, so it's south facing.
Mm.
But there is the back side of the building and the other side as well. So we could double it, more than double it, really, which we're looking at doing.
And have other businesses come to see you to say, well, actually, we quite like that?
Not to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the businesses that we work with in London are already on that route. They've already improved their energy generation.
So is Cumbria behind the curve on that one, then?
It depends on who you speak to. I think farming-wise, probably.
Yeah.
But I don't think the farmers are particularly helped by. I've heard of some farmers trying to put solar panels on their barns and be knocked back by the planning side of things, which is a shame. And I don't understand that. But yeah. Yes, it is. The other side of it as well, our hot water is generated by our fridges.
Yeah.
So that's called a heat exchange plate. So obviously we have chillers inside the fridges that are running. And then that is linked to what's called a condenser unit outside. And it's four big fans, basically. And we actually only need one to power the whole site, but we have four because we need that to generate hot water.
Right.
So each time a fridge goes on defrost, another fan will kick in. So it's constantly spinning, and it's that heat that we're harvesting,
right,
which generates our hot water. I think it's about 55 degrees, and we have a small immersion heater at the bottom with this massive water tank that takes up to 65, which is our sort of.
And how legal much of that is driven off the solar panels?
Hayden will be able to give you the exact details, but I think it's about somewhere about a third, I would say.
Right.
It's quite a lot.
So it's making a big difference to your bills.
Oh, huge.
Yeah,
massive.
Should we go and talk to one or two other people? Because I know you've got people here who I'd like to talk to about.
Yeah. Brace
about
yourself.
let's go and meet a couple of other folks.
Sure.
But for now, Phil, thanks very much indeed. That's brilliant.
Thanks, Pete.
So we've just been having a chat with Phil, and we've now got the financial controller. What's your name?
Katrina.
And you manage the money going in, money going out, all that side of things.
I am responsible for the money, yes.
So we've just been asking questions about the sustainability of the business, and I'm interested in solar panels and things like that. What's the story behind that aspect of what you're doing here in this business unit?
Okay, so, I mean, sustainability runs all through our business. It's not just about the environment. It's how this business is going to be sustainable in 5-10 generations' time.
Yeah.
And so every decision we make, we look at the bigger picture. We look at what's the impact on the environment. What should we be doing morally?
Mm-hmm.
But what's the financial impact? Because if bringing in something like solar panels on the roof drives us bankrupt next month,
yep,
because
yep,
we can't afford to pay the wages because we spent it on solar panels,
yep,
then we've achieved nothing.
Yeah. So you say morally, how do you just determine what's moral? Do you get together down the pub and have a beer and say?
No, we have management meetings, and sometimes it's a bun fight. So everybody has their own gauge of what moral is, and
yep,
mine is, if I was explaining this to a child, a young child, would I be proud to explain what I did?
Yeah.
Or would I feel a little bit awkward? Would I have to say, well, yes, of course, that died, or we damaged the planet, but we made profit? Because
yeah,
children don't really understand profit. They understand
yeah,
what they see as right and what they see as wrong.
Yeah. So that moral standing is that's an interesting way of looking at it. So from a child-centric view, is what's right and what's wrong.
Mm. That's mine. Everybody around the table will have different opinions
yeah,
on that, but that's how I gauge it.
So you've got solar panels.
Solar panels, heat reclaim system at the back
yep,
of the building. So fridges, in a nutshell, work by sucking hot air out
mm-hmm,
of outer spaces. We've got a state-of-the-art fridge system because it's integral to our business, keeping meat within the required food safety temperatures. So we suck the hot air out of the building and then use it to heat the water
mm-hmm,
that we use every single day to clean the building down from ceiling down to floor.
So you're required to do that as
day,
part of your operating standards, aren't you?
Yeah, we are required to do that for
yeah,
hygiene standards, and it uses an incredible amount of water
mm,
and an incredible amount of energy, but that doesn't actually cost us anything now. When we look at the cost of a project, we look at it financially
yep,
and in terms of time
yep,
and in terms of whether it helps all the departments in the business and the impact on the planet. But that never is really assessed on its own
mm,
because our company's mission is to provide a sustainable future for farming.
Mm-hmm.
And so it never runs through every single aspect. It would impact production, it would impact distribution, it would impact our supply chain, it would impact our customers. So we never have to look at it just on its own
mm,
because it's just part of the fabric of what we do.
So if you're a stick of rock, that's a celebrity, it goes through.
Yes.
It's the name in the middle of the rock.
Yes, we don't need to take that name out and just look at it in one...
Because I have this issue with sustainability. It's often an add-on. It's something, we ought to think about that because that's what our clients want us to think about. We'll appoint someone to that job and they'll... So that's covered, that's fine. Hmm. Business as usual. What you're saying is actually that's not how you do things here.
No. No, nothing is ever costed just for sustainability or decided upon just for sustainability. Because it's what we should be doing anyway.
Yeah. So in terms of you're an accountant, mm-hmm. so you can see where the money comes and the money goes.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saving lots of money by having solar panels and that heat, what's it, heat extraction, what's the word you reuse?
Heat exchange.
Does it pay for
yes
itself?
Yes and no. Everything becomes part of what we are prepared to do.
Yeah.
To provide a long-term future for this company.
Yeah.
Because if all the farmers go out of business because they can't produce food anymore for us, then we don't have a business.
Yeah.
So this... Our targets aren't set for... the profit in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. There is no end to where we want to be for when we want to go out of business. So all returns are infinite for us across where we look at them. Some things cost us money. The heat exchange costs us money. It's new technology. It's been difficult. It's taken commitment. We've had to really make the cleaners buy into this because it's like we could use the old-fashioned way and it's going to be reliable. It's going to work from day one. Everybody's got the manual. This is the easy way. Or we can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And you can explain this to your children and this could be working and somebody else might take this up because if we can prove it works...
Yeah.
Somebody else will buy it.
Yeah.
So do you want it to work? And that's ultimately, a project in this company will work if people want it to work because we will not give up.
The joy of having a small company is that you know everybody, don't you? You can look them in the eye, can't you?
Yes. And so we commit to projects and we commit to making them work. When the heat exchange failed at 3 o'clock in the morning, I was in my car driving to site with a hose pipe because it would have been my project that failed, as well as Phil's project that failed, as well as Dan's project that failed, as well as the whole company that fails, because if we don't keep it in business, we don't have jobs. And that's why things work here. And so we'll... Sorry, I've forgotten the question.
Don't worry, that's fine. That's fine. You're doing really well. Well, it was really about this is, you know, whether it's saving you money or whatever. But actually, what you're just explaining is that it becomes business as usual, but in a bit of sustainable business as usual, as opposed to just doing what you've always done, the cheapest route or the most, you know, apparently cost-effective way.
Mm. So the current project at the moment is, I'm not proud that we have polystyrene trays in this building.
Yeah.
I don't like it. And so I spoke to Dan and said, I'm just not proud of this. And so Dan, Phil and I sat down and said, no, we're none of us, no, this doesn't work for anyone. Production don't like them. They're not great. Phil doesn't like them. They're not very sustainable. Katrina doesn't like them because they're expensive.
Yeah.
We're going to make this work. We're going to change it. And we'll look at something and it might be sugarcane trays. And it's like, yeah, that's good, but they're really expensive. So how do we make this work? Do we need to find a saving somewhere else? Do we need to think about what else we could change to get us the money to do this? Or do we have to say, do you know what? We'll accept this additional cost for now until we can do this, and this will save us money. So the solar panels, yes, they saved us money. But that money wasn't treated as, and we can all have pay rises.
Yep.
So now we have something else to do that. We set our profits each year through a bun fight and a what do we want them to be? What level is sustainable?
Yeah.
And we don't then think, get greedy. We invest into projects if we have the money available. So quite often happens that we get a quick win on something. Something's more profitable than we thought it was, or cheaper than we thought it was, and then that will be ploughed into something that we're struggling with. So I don't know how we're going to get rid of these D18 trays. Neither does Phil yet, but he's going to come up with the answer. But it won't be driven by cost. It'll be driven by that desire to have them out of the business. Yeah. And I think probably myself, Phil as head of sustainability, and Dan as the managing director of this company are probably three of the most committed to making things work. So we very rarely ever fall out, because we're just three people like, we'll find a way. Impossible doesn't exist to us. Phil's favourite saying is, you know, well, we've all jumped out of the plane and now we just need to build the wings.
Yeah.
Or the parachute. So
which is great. One final question before you go. Are you happy, you're proud with where you've got to? Are you constantly working away in your mind and thinking, right, what next?
Yeah. What next? The more we fix, the more we see.
Yeah. And you've got this water issue, haven't you? You use a lot of water.
We use an awful lot of water, and it's wasteful. In reality, it's not particularly expensive for us.
Yeah.
But it's so wasteful that it must be hundreds, if not thousands, of gallons each night
cleaning
of
down.
Water that just is. It's very brown water when it goes down our plug hole. It's got cleaning fluid in it, and it's also got meat fat and juices in it. If we can extract that out and reuse it the next night, it's a no-brainer.
So that's the next big thing.
Yeah, that's a project for us. I don't think it'll be the most difficult project, but it'll come.
Brilliant. Thanks very much indeed for chatting to me. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye.
We just finished a conversation with you, and then you brought up the most eye-opening of things, which is that the people we're working with in your business are very often people who are actually living hand-to-mouth. Mm. And we raised the issue about how do we get sustainability into everybody, the person on the street.
So what I was saying is that some of our workforce do work live hand to mouth, and often will need a sub on a Monday to pay for the electric till they're next paid on a Friday, and they don't have the luxury of saying like organic was a luxury.
Yeah.
So if you're struggling to put food on a table on Thursday, then you're not going to choose the more expensive item. You don't have that luxury. So you don't have the luxury to have morals to say, well, this is, I'm going to pay a bit more for this. But they will choose not to eat meat with every meal, because they've seen the impact, not just on the environment, but actually on animal welfare. The quality of that meat, the way those animals, when you say animal welfare, the way the animals are born, live and killed impact the quality of the meat. Mm-hmm. And so they can tell, and some of them have actually worked in abattoirs. You know, the meat industry is very, very small. They've seen it, they've had to do it, and they've made the choice from knowing the impact on animal welfare not to eat meat every single meal, because they would rather eat high quality meat where they feel comfortable eating it, because
they
they've seen the actual is they've seen the reality of what cheap meat means to the animal being killed. But that cheap meat also costs the environment. Mm. Yeah. If it's intensely reared, it's been intensely farmed at the cost of animal welfare and our planet.
Can they see that in the meat they're butchering?
Definitely.
They can actually see the provenance of that animal, that beast, where it's come from, and how it's been made.
We can tell when meat enters our building, whether that animal has been stressed at slaughter, whether that animal has been fed junk grass that's just been covered in fertiliser, and and forced to grow quickly under the most intensive farming conditions when it enters the building.
But you've already paid for it at that point. You're not going to reject it at that point, are you?
We work very, very, very closely with farmers and are very closely with a fantastic small abattoir to prevent the farmers that we have close relationships having that point. We just wouldn't want to do it. Yeah,
but the guys can see it when if it was to occur, they can see it.
Yes, so obviously not all of our meat does come direct from farm, and some of it comes in from larger abattoirs that have been through, and they can see it. Yes,
I think that's fascinating. So me as a vegetarian, I look at all meat and think, oh, it's all pink. Yeah, but I know when a vegetable has been grown. I mean, our allotment vegetables are tasty as.
Yeah.
Wonderful. You go and buy the same tomato in the superstore down the road, it doesn't taste of anything.
Mm.
So it's fascinating how this translates across the whole food spectrum, doesn't it?
Yes. And most people that can see it, like farmers, it's not really a hard sell for them to try and get them to be more sustainable because they're in nature every day.
Mm.
Yeah, they can see how fantastic it is, how it can regenerate itself, but they also have to pay their mortgages.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so they have to make those hard moral decisions, don't they? Of, you know, do I sort of ruin that stream and destroy that bird's habitat, or do I lose the farm?
Yeah.
Do you know? And I it's a difficult decision.
These are the stark realities of being in business.
Yes, it is.
In a low margin business.
Yeah. And we do have, we have the luxury of being able to say no to some of our customers. So we have big corporate sort of purchasing engines that can exert a lot of pressure on us and say, can you take 3% off that price so that we can increase our spend with you? And we say no, because we've given you a fair price to bring that meat to you. It's of the highest possible quality because of what that farmer is able to do. And if we are squeezed and squeezed and squeezed, the people that ultimately pay that price is the planet and the animals.
Yeah.
They're the ones that suffer when somebody won't pay more for their meat.
Yeah, and actually that's a lot I hear is farmers are not paid enough for what they produce. The squeeze has come onto them,
mm-hmm.
and they're at the wit's end as to how to make a living.
Yes, they've been forced to make choices that they're not comfortable making.
Yeah,
and they've been forced to compromise animal welfare, meet minimum standards instead of ideal standards, so that they can keep hold of their farms and pass them to the next generation, or not to the next generation, just actually earn minimum wage, which a lot of them don't earn minimum wage, and that really starts responsibility for that starts with the end consumer. And animals can't speak, and the planet can't speak. People now are beginning to see that the planet is speaking. Do you know, farmers bear the brunt of those decisions, don't they? Because they're the ones that are trying to cope with fields that have never flooded in living history, but they see it flooding because it's their fields that are flooding. They're dealing with climate change because the planet is changing. It's here, it's now. They're the ones that are paying the price double. Not only have they been forced to make those decisions, but they're actually paying for the price for those decisions.
So. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
I came away from LDF uplifted by a conversation which covers lots of areas of concern for all of us. Next time on Treamble, we meet Gavin Lane in Norfolk. Gavin is an arable farmer looking at changes driven by climate and a desire to farm closer to nature. You've been listening to the Treamble podcast, written and produced by myself, Pete Leeson. My special thanks go to Pete Ord for his awesome production and mixing skills. And actually, Pete and Pete, both of us, we wrote the music, so thanks very much to Pete for his input there. The recording was on location with mixing and production at the studio at Sunbeams, part of the Annie Mawson Sunbeams Music Trust. Thanks also to all those lovely people who were interviewed. Simon Wakefield for the artwork, And my special thanks go to those who gave me the confidence and support to make this happen. Angela, Anne, Catherine, Tim, Kevin, Emma, Nick and Paul. Thank you.